Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In his new book, Gerald Nachman describes the essence of Ed Sullivan and his namesake television variety show in many ways. But given the season, I'll refer to one of them. He wrote that Ed was a weekly Santa Claus who would bring a bag of marvelous things into American homes. The name of the book is Right Here on Our Stage, Ed Sullivan's America, and author Gerald Nachman is with us to talk about that today. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, Ann. Thank you very much for having me on.
Appreciate it. In the title of your book, the subtitle, Ed Sullivan's America, seems to be more the thrust of the book in a way. The Right Here Tonight on Our Stage, Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, of course, was something that Ed Sullivan said every Sunday.
Several times every Sunday night. Yeah, well, I included that subtitle because I thought, you know, as I got into the subject, I realized this is more than just about the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, you know, pop culture in the 50s and 60s, and his show is such a cross-section of that, and it cut across all lines, ethnic lines, generational lines. This was in the era before the generation gap, before rock kind of, you know, split mm-hmm. the country into many factions.
He went on the air in 1948, was it?
Yeah, 48. It was really the first year that the TV logs were filled in with shows every hour. In 47, TV really began commercially, but there were big gaps of shows that, you know, hours that there was nothing on. But in 48, every hour was filled in. So he really got in on the very ground floor.
It's interesting about how he sort of plotted his way to the top.
Right,
he wasn't,
right.
But a lot of people, he was very criticized pretty roundly for many, many years. He wasn't necessarily well thought of as an MC.
No, he was clunky. He was wooden. He froze up in front of the camera. He was, but what people don't realize, and this I try to explain in the book, why was he fronting one of the biggest shows in television? People would sit at home and say, how did he get that job? Because they thought that's all he did, when in fact he had co-created the show, and he co-produced it. He was the one that auditioned the acts. Booked the acts, auditioned the acts, and chose the acts. And in fact, he had quite a bit of experience in hosting and producing. He did some stage shows in New York, produced some shows on Broadway, variety shows, and he had done a lot of World War II benefits, hosting and producing those. So he really was kind of a logical choice at the time because, as I say in the book, TV in the early days, there were no TV stars. TV had to create its own stars, and it did that by scooping up people who had been in nightclubs, on radio, every other venue.
He started out as a sports writer. He went to New York, or he grew up in New York. He became a Broadway columnist, but he was very ambitious. I mean, newspapers
right.
were never the be-all, end-all for him. He wanted to go all the way to the top of something.
Yeah, well, he was kind of known in New York. He'd start, as you say, as a sports writer. He grew up in a small town about 45 minutes outside of Manhattan, Portchester, New York. But he was born in New York, and he always had Manhattan in his bones,
mm-hmm.
Broadway, Times Square. He was just infatuated by show business. And he'd grown up going to a lot of vaudeville shows, and that's how he sat in on thousands of shows, and that's how he became a pretty good seat-of-the-pants producer. But he was, as you say, extremely ambitious. He didn't just want to be, he was a sports writer, but, you know, he wasn't that well-known except in the sports world. And then even as a Broadway gossip columnist, he was known around New York, and he worked for the New York Daily News, which I worked for briefly, which was the biggest newspaper in the country. But he wasn't that syndicated, and he envied Walter Winchell, who was his nemesis throughout his life, who was a big name. He had a huge syndication, Winchell did, and a big famous radio show every Sunday night. And Ed really, he wanted to be Walter Winchell.
His biggest competition when he first launched the show in 1948 was Milton Berle. And you compared Berle's impact on television in a really interesting way. You said it was the combined impact of Seinfeld, Sex and the City, and The Sopranos multiplied by 10.
Something like that. I just pulled that out of the air, of course. But the fact was, Berle was the first big show on TV. He really sold TV, and he sold TV to America. And people would stop in front of windows and in saloons. That's where most people first saw television, in taverns and so on, or at their a rich neighbor's house, got a TV set. And he was the one that really created television, Mr. Tuesday Night, as they called him. And Sullivan followed him by just a couple of weeks, actually, because Burl was on NBC, and CBS was looking for a show to try to counter that, even though they were on different nights. You know, they wanted a big show like Burl's. But the Sullivan show was totally different. It was a variety show. Sullivan was not famously a performer. And, you know, it wasn't basically a comedy show like Burl's.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. My guest right now, Gerald Nachman. He is the author of Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. It's interesting. You talk about the story of a show as a window on early television. So how does that he was early television?
Well, yeah, he did a lot of things. He did a lot of things that and early, you know, when you're first, you know, you become automatically a pioneer if you stick around long enough. And he did, not necessarily on purpose, but you know, his show in the early 50s was really the only show on television that regularly showcased black performers.
Yeah.
He was the first, and it was an interesting little, you know, backstory to that, because he had been a sports writer. He'd mixed easily with black athletes for all his life, and as a columnist, a Broadway gossip columnist, he often went up to Harlem to see shows at the Apollo and at the Cotton Club, and he got to know some, and he became aware of some of these great black performers that didn't have a showcase. So he put them on the show. He had no, you know, racist tendencies at all. He was very, very liberal. People thought he was an arch conservative because he dressed like a banker on the show, and he behaved like a banker on the show. But he really he thought, you know, for him, talent was the bottom line. And also if they were newsworthy, that's another aspect we could talk about, if they were in the
news. Yes, yes, yes. Well, Sugar Ray Robinson was both, you know, at one point.
Right, right, right.
And he had him on the show.
Well, he had him on the show for another reason. Another aspect of this story is that Sullivan was a soft touch for old, you know, fading athletes and vaudeville stars who he had a real sentimental feeling for. And Sugar Ray Robinson's, after his boxing days were over, he tried to make it as a tap dancer. He never did.
Mm-hmm.
But Sullivan, out of sympathy and out of regard, really had him on the show six or seven times as dancing.
In the late 50s, he started to get some real heat, though, for showcasing black entertainers. How did he handle that criticism? I know that he buckled under the pressure from McCarthyism.
Right. That was a kind of two strains. He was kind of a heroic guy when it came to booking blacks and standing up to some of the Southern CBS affiliates that couldn't believe. You know, he would get a lot of heat when he would not just have the black performers on, but when he would go over and actually shake Nat King Cole's hand or embrace Pearl Bailey. That was sort of unheard of, at least in the South, that you would do that. So he got a lot of heat from them and from some of his sponsors too, who didn't like that. And you know, it was a totally different time. So, but he stood up to it, and he almost supposedly punched out a sponsor that gave him some heat in the studio about booking a black performer. So he was pretty, and he was a hero in the black community. And a quote from some black newspapers of how he would. I think Ralph Bunche said Ed Sullivan is democracy or something like that. And he was a real pioneer in that way.
I suppose in that way, more than almost any other, is what made him that window on America, because it really did show all sides of America. You mentioned that for a lot of blacks, that was the first time I'd ever seen anybody who was black on television.
Yes, and I quote a black author named Mel Watkins, who's written about black entertainers. He said it would be a big event in his house when they found out there was going to be a black performer on, like Sammy Davis, and they would all gather around. So it was pretty rare to see a black performer on television in those kind of lily white days.
He wasn't an absolute paragon of virtue. There was one time he liked to control what went on his show, and one time he offended, I cannot remember the name of the fellow, but he offended somebody by saying that you're the first black to stand up to me and give me any trouble. because he didn't want to play the song that Ed wanted him to play.
Yeah.
And that was very offensive.
Yes, right. He didn't like to be double-crossed by anybody of any color.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually Bo Diddley.
Bo Diddley. Mm-hmm.
Who Ed wanted to have on the show to sing, I think it was 16 Tons, the old Tennessee Ernie Ford hit. And Bo Diddley wanted to sing his namesake song, and he did. And Sullivan was very upset with that. He vowed never to have any black performers on. And that's not black performance, but any rock performance. I'm sorry, terrible slip. Rock was pretty new in those days, mm-hmm. and that's why he was very wary of ever booking Elvis Presley, because Presley came on not long after Bo Diddley, but because Ed had the run-in with Bo Diddley, he was not anxious to have another rocker on.
One of the most famous. He was an entertainer, he's a black athlete, is Muhammad Ali. He appeared on the show on February 2nd, 1963, and we have Ed asking him how long he would last in the ring. We have a cut from that right now. Let's listen to it.
Okay.
I know that your next heavyweight opponent is going to be Doug Jones. You're going to fight him on March 13th, and poetically you've said where? What?
Well, Doug Jones presently is ranked number 3 in the top 10 heavyweights of the world. I'm ranked number 2. I understand that Jones liked to mix, but he must fall in 6.
He must fall in 6. Now, you mark that down, Now, you did the same thing with Archie Moore. You call around. Suppose I were to box you. How far would I go?
Well, Ed, if you run, I'll have to cut it to 1.
One
punch.
No.
That was Ed Sullivan and Muhammad Ali in February 2nd, 1963. Ed sounded kind of loosey-goosey there.
He was, as I say, he was very much at home with athletes,
mm-hmm.
and he remained friends with a lot of them. Ed had actually started as a jock. He played sports in 11 letters in high school, and he was briefly a semi-pro catcher. And he always felt at home with athletes, but not so much with performers. He was in awe of performers, but he never felt at ease among performers, and he had very few friends. Among show people, Jerry Vale, the old Italian singer, that was the only friend, that really close friend of his that I could track down. And I talked to him, as I did to many.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gerald Nachman. He is the author of a new biography of Ed Sullivan, but actually it's Ed Sullivan's show right here on our stage tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. If you would like to speak with Gerald or talk about some reminiscence you might have of the Ed Felt Sullivan Show, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have more cuts coming up from the Ed Sullivan Show. Stay tuned. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Join WOSU Public Media for an exclusive family event to help your kids record a holiday greeting. Each family will receive a PBS Kids USB bracelet with their recording safely stored on it. Space is limited, with one USB bracelet per family. Call 614-292-9678 to register.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 35 degrees in downtown Columbus, a chance of rain mixing with sleet this afternoon, steady temperatures in the mid-30s, rain tonight as well, and a low of 35 tonight, temperatures rising to 43 after midnight, and we have a high wind watch in effect for tomorrow morning through tomorrow night.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer, a family-owned Midwest supercenter. Meijer offers apples locally grown by Ohio farmers. More information is available at Meijer.com.
Everybody's feeling gay when they hear this fella say.
There's a really big shoe tonight. A really big show tonight.
We got 16 tons of atomic ore. We got next year's Army Navy score. And the first 4 battles of the Civil War.
It's a really big show tonight.
It's a really big show tonight.
Shoe, not show.
It's a really big shoe tonight.
Now you've got it. We've got a spaceship blasting off for you and an in-person visit from the entire Bronx Zoo.
That is the Kirby Stone 4. They were in a... Had you heard that?
Where you found that? That's so... in the enterprising view, I've never heard that. That's great. It was a record made by them, huh?
My producer, Linda Taylor, found that on YouTube.
Oh, my gosh.
Just Google it. I had never heard of the Kirby Stone 4, I admit.
Yeah, well, I had heard of them, but I never heard that record. And I guess that was a little, the story behind the really big shoe is, of course, he never really said that, but got a famous impressionist of the time named Will Jordan was the first guy to kind of crystallize Ed Sullivan's weird personality and speech patterns and garbled syntax and everything else, and he put it into a great impersonation. And then Sullivan felt kind of obliged to imitate Jordan imitating him. By referring to a really big shoe.
So that he didn't. The genesis was not with Ed Sullivan on that line. Then.
Well, he said really big show all the time, but he didn't say shoe.
Okay.
he did have a very peculiar way of talking that Jordan managed to imitate brilliantly. And then a lot of comics of impressionists began to imitate Jordan, and so that's kind of the image we have of Ed Sullivan today. Is capsulized in that Will Jordan impression, which was in 1953 and 1954. A guy named John Biner came along later and kind of refined it. A lot of comics went on, and there was kind of a rumor in the industry that you had, if you were a comedian and wanted to be on the show, you better perfect an Ed Sullivan impression, because he grew to like it, even though he was a very thin-skinned guy in the early days, as you alluded to earlier. Took a lot of abuse, and then he later decided to, go with the joke and make fun of himself, and that kind of helped warm him up.
Well, that was part of, part of his success. He just kept plowing ahead. He was thin-skinned.
Absolutely.
He was offended by the criticism, but it didn't stop him.
Oh, yeah. People, his first reviews were just devastating, and anyone else would have just kind of probably not buckled under or had the show taken away from him. In fact, William Paley at CBS had planned to replace him because the early reviews of Ed Sullivan, not the show, but of Sullivan himself, were so devastating, and they called him Liver Lips, and the shows were called The Knights of the Living Ed, and Mr. Rigor Mortis, and he just, the interesting thing about Sullivan was he was he'd been a newspaper man, he still was, till the end of his life.
Which
really.
I did not know that.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't know that. Yeah, he was a newspaper man all throughout. He held on to his column, and so for him, TV critics, he didn't have any special regard for TV critics, who were just his fellow rumpled colleagues. and he would write them personal letters, replying to their hostile reviews with equally hostile letters. And, as I say in the book, a real performer would never do that. But Sullivan didn't care. He didn't consider himself a performer, and he wouldn't take any guff. He was a very volatile guy. But it would all blow. He had a huge, kind of Irish temper, but it would it would quickly subside.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to phone in to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU, my guest is Gerald Nachman. He is the author of Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. And Jerry, you are on the air. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Ms. Fisher, Mr. Nachman. Got a really big, really, really big show tonight. Did he write the column Talk of the Town?
Well, people get that name mixed up. The Talk of the Town is what the New Yorker's lead section is called. People always confuse it.
Yeah.
It was called Toast of the Town originally.
Toast of the Town, okay.
Toast of the Town until 1955, and then when they finally decided they weren't going to replace him, they changed the name of the show to The Ed Sullivan Show.
Well, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
I'm not sure I got the thrust of the whole question. What was the rest of the question?
That was the question. Toast of the Town. That's right. Also, I want to mention that Nat King Cole took an awful lot of abuse when he bought that home in Brentwood out in L.A. right after the war. And they say that if he had been white, he would have outdone Frank Sinatra. Now, that was an article in the New Yorker about 10 or 12 years ago. But...
Cole got his TV show. He's a black. He was the first black performer to have his own TV show. It didn't last very long because sponsors were afraid to back it.
Yeah, they didn't.
And it was because of Cole's performances on the Sullivan Show that he got his own show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was great. By the way, Mr. Nachman, you wrote "Raised on Radio," didn't you?
I did. Thank you for mentioning it.
I read the book. And, Ms. Fisher, I wish you'd get Mr. Nachman back on for some of us old-timers that remember Captain Midnight, Jack Armstrong, and Fred Allen, you know.
Yeah, I wrote that about 10 years ago, and it really came from the gut because I grew up with all those.
So did I. And I wanted to say, did you ever read Fred Allen's book, Treadmill to Oblivion?
I did, and one of the great titles.
Right.
It really is.
Most people
talking
don't know
about his years in show business. To Oblivion.
I loved Allen's Alley.
Oh yeah, that was a great.
That
show.
Was and great. And but anyway, I make a note of that, Mystery.
Yes, I will.
Mr. Nachman back on. I love that book, and I loved old time radio. I was raised on radio too, Mr.
Allen
Nachman.
Can never make it in radio. I mean, he can never make it on TV. I'm sorry, he tried.
He did. Yeah. Well, he had those bags under his eyes, and as Jack Benny used to say, "Oh, you mean that old octogenarian?"
Thanks, Jerry.
Yeah, just a minute. I wanted to say one other thing. Herman Wouk was one of Fred Allen's writers in the early days.
Yeah, right. Correct. Very good.
Yeah. Very
good.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Great show, Ms. Fisher.
Thanks, Jerry. Enjoy Thanks it. For calling.
Too many juries, I forgot.
Yeah, there. That's right. If you want to get that Kirby Stone 4 cut, if you want to hear the whole thing, you can just Google the words Ed Sullivan and Really Big Show, and spelled properly. It's the first thing that comes up, apparently, according to my producer, Amy Jurevich. So you might want to give that a listen. The whole story, we were all chuckling, cackling in the office one day listening to it. Just not enough time to play the whole thing. Ed Sullivan loved to discover talent. He would travel all over the world, wouldn't he, or at least all over the country, checking out acts.
Yeah.
And
well, he had scouts in Europe and everywhere,
yeah.
And he relied on them. And another pioneering thing about the show is TV show that had really global reach. I mean, most of the performers he had on were like acrobats from Tokyo or Czechoslovakia or something, or tumblers. But he did. He was interested in going beyond, the borders. And but something that people, there's kind of a myth about the show that he discovered a lot of talent. He didn't really discover so much talent as he did give talent that had already proven itself in some other way in clubs or on recordings, and he would put them on television, and then, of course, that would catapult them into national.
Well, you mentioned he always had the best tumblers, the best plate spinners, the best,
Right. He wanted the best no matter how trivial the act, and he just had to That was his bottom line.
The best
that money could buy, and he did pay fairly good prices for talent in those days.
Eventually, but he started out on a horrible budget. Was it $285 a week or something horrible?
$375 for a talent budget, and the first show was his first coup. Really, was getting Martin and Lewis on TV. They'd never been on television before.
Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin.
Right.
The other thing different about him at the time was how he brought the whole family together in front of the television set. I think I was Topo Gigio was for me, and so were the acrobatic acts. But when I was reading the reminiscence of just ordinary people throughout your book, some people hated that stuff. They were there for the opera, or they were there for the more.
Well, as I say in the book somewhere, that if you watched an hour, sooner or later you would see something you really liked. But you'd have to sit through stuff you weren't so crazy about. A lot of people couldn't stand Topo Gigio. I never understood what the appeal was, but it was on many, many times. The little rubber mouse.
It was the kids, because I watch it now and it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I like that.
How they did that, and I kind of explained how they. It's a kind of you can't describe it. It takes too long, but it was a very complicated. They had six people. people working the various parts of the mouse's body. And the whole point of having that little guy on was it helped to endear Ed Sullivan to the audience. He would interview this little mouse, this little rubber mouse. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. 614-292-8513. Alan, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Oh, yes. I remember reading Bob Schieffer's 50 Years of Face the Nation, I think that was the name of the book, where Ed Sullivan, unbeknownst to the same CBS Face the Nation people, actually had the first interview of Castro when he took over Cuba.
You're right. Absolutely right. He snuck down there. Ed Sullivan was not content with... He was very famous, and he was, you know, he knew, he wasn't content with just being a host of a variety show on Sunday night. He sort of wanted to start having some journalistic coups. So he snuck down to Cuba, and he interviewed Castro and put Castro on. He thought it would be the first time, but Schieffer obviously pointed out that Face the Nation scooped him by a few hours, and they had him on that morning. So Ed wanted to be Ed Murrow as well. It didn't work out.
Well, he had lots of times people would just pop up in the audience, famous people who were in the news. Did he pay them to be there?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things I found out. They did. I didn't realize that. They paid him $1,000 to stand up in the audience and wave. And it was, hello?
Yep, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. And it was Sullivan's way. I don't think he really thought it through this much, but it was Sullivan's way of proving that anyone who was anyone was either on the show or in the audience. But you thought, gee, that's interesting. Fred Astaire sitting out there watching the show, must be an important show. But in fact, they were booked and paid.
Well, I fell for it at the time. Genesis, though, for the kind of the makeup of the show is really vaudeville. It wasn't new, was it?
No. He grew up going to vaudeville, mm-hmm. which is the major entertainment of his time, aside from movies. And people kind of dismissed it as just another vaudeville show. But he really, as I say, streamlined vaudeville, because if you went to a vaudeville show, I'm not old enough to have done that, but it was 2 or 3 hours. He'd sit there, watch an act for 20 minutes. But on TV, you couldn't do that. He would cram 7 or 8 acts into 1 hour. And, he had to pare down all kinds of performers to, you know, their best 5 minutes. So you'd get one song, maybe 2 songs if they were especially big singer, and 5 minutes of a comedy, of a comedian. So, and that drove the comedians crazy, the way he would... He would really be very careful about vetting comedians. He would have them, if he hadn't seen them in a club, he would have them come over to the hotel. The Sullivans lived in hotels all their lives.
Interesting life, family life, too.
Great. What's that?
Interesting family life.
Well, yeah, we can get into that, too. But it was very unusual. They lived in hotels. They lived at the Astor and then the Delmonico Hotel on Park Avenue. But he would have the comedians come over and audition for him in the hotel lobby. So there would be a comedian, you know, used to a crowd, breaking up people, and there would be, you know, just Sullivan sitting there glumly with his, legal pad on the clipboard, kind of just staring at the comedian, you know, and the comedian trying to get a laugh out of this guy. And it was like performing before a statue. And then he would ask the comedians to cut their stuff down, but then he would also... Often when they were performing on stage, I have to remember it was a live show. All TV was live in those days,
right.
50s, all the way through a lot of the 60s. And they would have to cut their act while they were performing when Ed Sullivan would give them a one finger or two finger sign, and they have to do that while they're performing, which as I say drove them crazy.
At the front of your book, you mentioned it was sort of a shame that he had 10,000 acts on his show, something like that. But he's really remembered for only 6 or 7 of them. And one of them, of course, is the Beatles and their debut on February 9th, 1964. And we have that cut right now. We can listen to a little bit of it.
And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan.
Thank you, Greg. Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's
Wow, those were the good old days. They weren't on television very much after that, but they were on the Ed Sullivan Show four times.
Right, and the Beatles story has been told so many times,
right.
So many ways. I tried to, that was a real challenge. I tried to find some new behind-the-scenes information about how they happened to land on the Sullivan Show. It wasn't by accident. It was a carefully calculated maneuvering by their manager, Brian Epstein, and by a lot of behind-the-scenes people. Sullivan, he trusted his nose for news. He did not necessarily trust, he didn't trust his instinct when it came to rock and roll. It was all new to him. It was not his idea of music. He was interested in people like Frankie Lane and Sophie Tucker and, Marie Chevalier. That was his idea of singers, Connie Francis. Because the Beatles had made such a splash in Europe and Walter Cronkite had him on the news, and Sullivan sort of saw it on there. He said, well, if it's on Cronkite's show, it must be newsworthy. So he went with that. And then an unknown guy named Sid Bernstein, who was booking acts for Carnegie Hall, decided to take a chance and book them at Carnegie Hall. So on the basis of that, Sullivan said, okay, I'll take a shot.
And it was a good shot.
Yeah, right, it was. Yeah.
We're going to take a break right now. If you would like to speak to Gerald Nachman, he's the author of Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a few more cuts, so stay tuned. All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Robin D.G. Kelly talks about his new biography of jazz pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. Kelly's learned many things about Monk's life, music, and mental health problems. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. The sixth season of Art Scene continues on WOSU-TV. Tomorrow night at 7:30, celebrate the Thurber House's 25th anniversary with a look back at the history of the Thurber home. Art Scene gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus. Watch Art Scene Wednesday at 7:30 on WOSU-TV. 35 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today, and a chance of rain mixing with sleet this afternoon. Steady temperatures in the mid-30s. Rain tonight and a low of 35. Temperatures rising a little bit throughout the night to 43 degrees after midnight. And then we have a high wind watch in effect from tomorrow morning through tomorrow night. Expect wind gusts of up to 45 to 55 miles per hour for tomorrow. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Meet me on Ed Sullivan.
Oh, I'd die. What would I wear?
Oh, gee, Ed Sullivan. He's my favorite human. Me on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Ed Sullivan.
Me, Harry McAfee, appearing with
Ed Sullivan.
Okay, that is a hymn for a Sunday evening. It's from Bye Bye Birdie, the movie in 1963, and it's hysterical. Once again, recommend listening to the whole song. It was in 1963, though. It's sort of after his heyday, wasn't it?
It was in the middle.
Middle,
of the heyday,
okay.
Actually, yeah, he was still pretty hot then. The show Bye Bye Birdie is kind of centered around, you know, it's about the, it's a satire of the Elvis Presley mania.
Right.
And Elvis Presley going on the show.
And, of course, Elvis was on the show. Maybe we can listen to that right now and then take a caller.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, and as much as he goes to the coast now for his new picture, this will be the last time that we'll run into each other for a while. But I wanted to say to Elvis Presley and the country that this is a real, decent, fine boy. And wherever you go, Elvis... guys who accompany you over there, we want to say that we've never had a pleasanter experience on our show with a big name than we've had with you. You're thoroughly all right. So now, let's have a tremendous hand for a very nice person.
Okay, and that very nice person was Elvis Presley. And Terry, you're on the air. You wanted a question about that.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that Ed, you know, it showed his importance. Because parents are very worried about rock and roll. They thought, mm-hmm. what are their kids getting involved in? This is the, you know, it had terrible overtones of decadence at the time. But by him putting Elvis on and later the Beatles, he kind of legitimized rock and roll, and he made it okay. And as he goes out of his way to say, you're a thoroughly all right young man, you're a fine young man, we've never had such a good experience.
He sounded almost relieved.
Yeah, surprise, exactly. I don't think he really cared, you know, didn't probably like Elvis at all as a performer, but yeah, relieved is exactly right. He thought, well, this guy didn't ruin our show, so, and in fact, it kind of opened the door to rock, of course. Actually, the Beatles did more of that than mm-hmm. Elvis did, but, and then, there's a later story about how rock on TV later kind of sowed the seeds of his demise, the show's demise, because it lost a lot of its core audience. But that's a different subject.
Okay, Terry, you're on the air. You have a question.
You say Terry?
Terry, I did.
Yeah, okay. I was going to talk about Elvis myself. I want to clear something up. It's been misreported in a lot of books how Elvis was always filmed from the waist up on The Sullivan Show, and that's not really true. During the first three shows he was on Sullivan Show, he was photographed normally and really rocked out. And then the final time he was on, they showed him from the waist up.
That's correct. That's a very interesting point. And that does get confused. And the reason was that he was in L.A. He was making his first movie, I think. And Sullivan sent his co-producer, a guy named Marlo Lewis, out there to make sure, because I guess there had been too much backlash against the writhing and gyrations and all mm-hmm. that stuff, and Elvis the pelvis and so on. But Sullivan had this weird idea that Elvis would shove a Coke bottle down the front of his pants to make him look a little more manly. So anyway, so that's one reason he didn't want to shoot him from the waist down.
Mm-hmm. Another thing was that just before that, he'd been on the Steve Allen Show, Elvis had, and they wouldn't let him do his signature moves at all. They showed him all the way, but they had him stand stock still for the songs.
Yeah, and they had him. They kind of made fun of him because Allen was also not a fan of rock and roll,
right,
in those days. And so they had him. You know, the famous sketch, which we've probably seen the scene from, where he had Elvis singing "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog" to a real hound dog.
Right.
And they would kind of make fun of the whole Elvis phenomenon, and there are various theories whether Elvis hated that or he put up with it because they put him on, you know, national television for the first time, and he was not on Sullivan Show. First of all, he was on a show called Dorsey Brothers. Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey had a summer show. And then Gleason was kind of responsible because he was producing that show, of getting Elvis on that show. And from there, he went to the Allen Show and then to Ed Sullivan.
Okay,
and, of course, Milton Berle's show also.
Oh, yeah, probably. Well, you know your Elvis history. That's
Thanks, Terry, for calling.
Sure, I got one more point I'd like to make out real quick. Mad Comics had a satire on Ed Sullivan. You mentioned different names they give him, and they called him Ed Sullen Pan.
I never heard that one.
Yeah, no Mad Comics. Well, thanks. I'm going to read your book for sure.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Sure. I think it's a nice show. You only have people named Jerry on.
Sorry. You know, it's been confusing for me too. I forget myself. I wanted to tell our listeners that tonight at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV, you can see and hear a lot more of these sorts of cuts from the rock days. It's Ed Sullivan's Rock and Roll Classics, the 60s. So you might want to check that out tonight at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV. So who was the bigger act at the time of Ed Sullivan? There's debate about that. Elvis, he kicked off what you refer to as the youth quake in 1954, or was it the Beatles that you described sort of as having the same effect? You didn't use the word, I don't think, but it sounded like, felt like a meteor hit. Maybe yeah. I've been watching too many 2012 references.
Yeah,
but
I think the Beatles were the bigger, okay. bigger act for sure. Elvis was pretty big, but then after Elvis, the show kind of settled back into its old ways. But after the Beatles, it really didn't. It felt obliged to have, because having the Beatles on opened the door to rock in America. I mean, it had been around, of course, but it was, as I say, by being on the Sullivan Show, it legitimized it, and other rock acts felt they had to be on the Ed Sullivan Show for a while. But then later on, this strange phenomenon set in where they rock really didn't until MTV, rock was really at odds with television. They rock acts needed, you know, recordings, and they needed concert dates, but they did not need TV, and they needed radio, of course, airplay, but they didn't need television, and the Sullivan Show, after a while, was thought by many rock acts, by the harder-edge rock acts, like the Rolling Stones and so on, and the Doors, as being passé and square, and they really didn't want to be associated with that.
You know, there's a section in the book that I thought was interesting. It kind of reminded me of the dilemma that a lot of the major political party, or the major political parties in this country face right now. You wrote that Sullivan was juggling two opposing forces, attempting to offer wildly popular new voices without alienating original viewers. It was a basic fight for the soul of the Sullivan Show and of Sullivan. I thought that was an interesting.
Well, right. I say he was very much of a conservative, culturally conservative. But you know, as I said, he was a Democrat. He was an FDR Democrat. Mm-hmm. So there were all these opposing strains going on in the country. Forces mm-hmm. going on in the country at the same time, and he was trying to balance all that, which is very hard to do. So he wanted to have on the older acts, the older vaudevillians, and some of the traditional artists, like, as I said, you know, Frankie Lane and Teresa Brewer, and the real pop, the pre-rock era ballad pop singers, mm-hmm. Johnny Mathis, but he also wanted to cater to what was hot and new. That, as I say, was always the bottom line with him. It wasn't so much. It was always talent, as you said. It was the best that he could get on, the best that he could buy. But he also wanted to have on what was hot, and so he kind of lost control of the show because of that. Because he had very sure instincts about traditional mainstream entertainment, but not rock. He didn't really understand rock, and he had to trust his. He had a young son-in-law who came in one day, he was not yet 30, a guy named Bob Precht, who began co-producing the show the last 12 years of its existence. And Precht, who was younger, brought in a lot of the rock acts. He brought in some of the cutting-edge comics like Richard Pryor, people like that, George Carlin. Mm-hmm. Sullivan kind of handed the show over in a way to Precht at that point. He was getting older. As I say, he lost some of his traction. He didn't trust his instincts with some of the modern acts.
Okay, we have a listener right now. If he's on the phone, 614-292-8513. If you'd like to call, he wants to talk about Ed Sullivan and McCarthyism a little bit. We talked about that earlier, but John, I'm curious about your question.
Right. Well, the report I heard was that he threatened to out some entertainment industry individual as gay if he didn't rat out other people to the House on American Activities Committee.
That was Jerome Robbins, the choreographer.
Yeah, I guess I'm left wondering who made him the enforcer and why he got involved with that.
Well, that's a whole side of him that's not the most flattering side of Ed Sullivan. Mm-hmm. While he embraced blacks, he caved into McCarthyism, and it wasn't so much him. His politics, as I say, were fairly liberal, but it was CBS. It was known as virulently anti-communist, and they didn't want to have any so-called tainted performers on the show. And Sullivan, you know, the show was foremost in his life. He did not want to lose that show. So as a result, he was looking out for number one, and he didn't want to cross CBS, so he went along with it, even though his sympathies were not necessarily anti-communist. He just did it for pure commercial personal reasons.
All right, John, thanks for your call.
And he wasn't a vindictive...
You're there. Jerry.
He wasn't a vindictive guy like Walter Winchell. He didn't become a crazed, you know, right winger or anything. He went along with the sympathies of the time, with the feelings of the time.
You know, I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about the fact that he wrote that column till the very end. I as a former columnist myself, I thought that was fascinating. I mean, he certainly didn't have to do that, but then, and I wondered about it, but then you wrote that if the TV show was the carrot, the column was the stick, and that he wrote it all the way to the end because he thought he needed it.
Right. That's a very interesting point and a good question. After the TV show became a big hit, he thought, well, I don't need this column anymore. I want to give that up. It's just a nuisance. And his assistant really kind of put the items together. I'm sure he looked at it, maybe made a few changes, but he didn't really write it per se in the last few years because he didn't have time and he didn't care that much about it. But his co-producer, Marla Lewis, talked him into keeping the column because he says that gives you credibility. You're not just another TV performer that can be fired. And Ed Sullivan used the column to get performers on. He leveraged that column because it had some clout, and he would plug performers who were on the show. So it really was the stick and the show, as you say, was a carrot. And he was very wisely held on to the column, even though it wasn't a hugely successful column around the country. It was important in New York, and New York was still the center of entertainment
right.
in those days.
Right, and it was more about the people he booked than about the people that were listening and watching at home.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We talked about his ambitions earlier. We haven't talked about what you called the heart of an autograph collector.
Yeah, called the soul of a mogul and the heart of an autograph.
Right.
Yeah, he was both. He was really a CEO. A lot of his friends were kind of mogul types. He was really kind of a mogul type, and he wasn't. He liked being a big shot, that's for sure. And he did, as I say, he was awestruck by talent, by entertainers. But he really he really had kind of a corporate view of the show.
You know, I was sort of surprised at the money he was making early on. You mentioned it was something like $3,000 a week when he was booking those reviews mm-hmm. and producing them. And how much money did he make?
He made maybe, I forget exactly. I think it was, in those days, it was a lot of money, I guess. About $150,000 a year.
Yeah, that's what I'm, in those days, though.
In the 50s, that was a lot of money, and even in the 60s. So, you know, he did all right, but he wasn't a rich guy by any means. He just had the mogul mentality, and he wasn't in it for the money. He was in it for the recognition. He loved
Yeah, and he loved being around famous people.
He loved being around famous people. He loved being recognized in New York. You know, he lived, as I said earlier, he lived in hotels his whole adult life, and he loved walking down the street, and you know, he would run into agents and performers and athletes and publicists, and he was, you know, pretty much couch out to wherever he went and went, and he really loved that. And he and his wife tried to move to the suburbs, mm-hmm. Connecticut, for a couple of years, and he hated it. And I say in the book that the quiet nights and the rustling leaves kept him awake.
Yeah, I think she said, you mentioned that when she saw him out there raking leaves one day, she decided it was time to go.
Yes, it's time to move. But she couldn't believe her husband was doing that. You know, they did try to become suburban dwellers, but it didn't work. He loved Manhattan. He was a true Broadway baby.
You said that he had three families. He had an unusual private life. He had a very pretty tight relationship with his family, but he was a regular philanderer, too.
He was, pretty much so. He liked girl, had a very major weakness for girl singers, and he pursued a lot of them, and he had several flings. Nothing ever threatened his marriage. He was a very devoted husband in his way, and he would call his wife after every show, Sylvia, and ask her what she thought of the show. He trusted her instincts. But he did wander a bit, and he pursued people like Phyllis McGuire and
from the McGuire sisters.
Of the McGuire sisters, Phyllis McGuire, and Polly Bergen told me some stories about him trying to date her after the show, and he didn't get anywhere with them, but he did with other singers whose names wouldn't mean anything to anyone today. But, you know, he was a very good father, a very supportive father. I talked to his daughter, Betty, still alive, and Bob Precht, who she's married to. I talked to them, and I was very happy to hear that Bob said he really liked the book. He thought it was the best research. It made me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it did. He was, I tried to get a show, had some warts and all. But, you know, it is important to realize, as you made the distinction earlier, it's really what I call a biography of the Ed Sullivan Show, not so much of Sullivan, although there's a lot of biographical stuff about Sullivan because they obviously overlap.
You know, you used reminiscence of regular viewers, and you sprinkled them throughout the book, and I really didn't stop to look at them until this morning. I went through them, and I enjoyed it so much, and like I said earlier, that sort of underscored to me the Ed Sullivan's America, the subtitle of the book right here on our stage tonight. How did you pick those? We just have about half a minute left.
Some of them are my friends.
Okay.
I went to my friends, and I said, tell me what your reminiscences were of growing up watching the Sullivan Show. And I talked to, you know, there's probably about 20 or 25 scattered throughout the book. And then I got some on the Internet, from the Internet, people that had Ed Sullivan website and so on had stuff. And I used people I didn't know. I tried to make it geographical and tried to make the point, as you just said, that it really was permeated our lives, you know, at a certain time and everywhere in America. And it was what they now call appointment TV, where you would watch, everyone would gather. This is hard to believe now, but for younger people, that the entire family would gather and watch the same TV show. Sort of amazing to think now.
Yeah, I can remember it. Well, there was only one television, for one thing.
Well, there's
in most homes.
One TV set and only three networks, and that was only a couple shows. You know, the other networks threw about 20 shows opposite Sullivan over the years, 23 years, and only two really made any kind of a dent, and one was the Colgate Comedy Hour, and one was the Steve Allen Sunday Night Show, and they lasted for about four or five shows and 4 or 5 years. And then they finally decided to hand Sunday night back to Ed Sullivan.
You know, we've run out of time, Jerry. This is Gerald Nachman. He's the author of Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Ann, I really appreciate being on the show, and they're really good questions.
Thank you.
You obviously read the book.
I sure did.
I'm flattered.
Thank you. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.